This episode of Songs and Stories is with Curtis Eller. He's another artist that I encountered in the summer of 2009, just as I was starting out as a musician. He was opening for the Squirrel Nut Zippers at the Highline Ballroom in New York City as a solo act, and immediately captivated me with his performance style, his music, evocative lyrics, and storytelling. Now, if you haven't seen Curtis live, his performance involves a fair amount of high kicks, some light yodeling, and absolutely no recognition of the fourth wall. And not only will he physically go out into the crowd, but he always makes an effort to connect with his audience through his storytelling and interaction. I mean, there's no such thing as a heckler at a Curtis Eller show. I can attest. I've witnessed on several occasions that he will gladly yield the floor to an audience member's drunken aside and find some way to connect that person's observation back to his own life and effortlessly weave the whole thing back into his set. It is this humble podcaster's opinion that Curtis Eller is an undiscovered national treasure. America would be well served by celebrating his recorded material, his live performances, and his biography, and adding his story to our own national identity. That's a bold statement, but before you dismiss it, you owe it to yourself to see him live. Thanks for listening, and now enjoy the songs and stories of Curtis Eller.
Well, step back from that turnstile, Matthew, Mark, and Paul. My heart is brittle as a spider, and these ain't my wings at all. And you know, you're never gonna hide that scar. Wait, no, you're never gonna hide that scar.
So you were born in Detroit, and your father ran the Hiller Old Time Circus.
That's right, yeah. He was really a gym teacher in the Hiller School District.
Really?
In suburban Detroit, yeah. And he started teaching the kids in his gym class how to juggle and ride unicycles and, you know, do back flips and stuff like that. And eventually some of them got really good at it, and he started a local circus, you know, in suburban Detroit. And it was mostly acrobatics and some trapeze and wire walking and unicycling. It wasn't like animals or anything of that nature. You know, it's more sort of classic 50s American acrobatic circus. And it ran for a few years when I was a little kid. And it was kind of a nice thing because, you know, my dad got known as the guy who was passing on these circus skills to a younger generation of people. So, you know, he knew a lot of the big time circus people. So when Ringling Brothers would come through, you know, we'd get to talk to those people and stuff, go backstage.
And how did he know people from the bigger circuses? What?
Well, my dad was. He's kind of an obsessive character, you know, whatever strikes his interest, he goes full out on it for, you know, a long time. And he came to it through, like, when he was a kid, he wanted to be like a strong man, like a bodybuilder and all that. And I think he saw these, like, circus performers as being, you know, people in peak physical condition or something. And he just got obsessed with it. And, you know, he would write to them. I know that he went down to Sarasota, Florida, which is where, the Ringling Brothers and other circuses would spend their off season. They would live there, and like a lot of retired circus performers lived there. And so my dad went down and he sought out the Carl and Herman Walenda from the Great Walenda's wire walking troupe. And I know he knew them, and, you know, I have a couple of books that he has that are signed by them. Like, in fact, there's a book called The Pictorial History of the American Circus, which is where I got my band name from. And it's this old picture book of circus, and it's signed Best Regards from Herman Walenda. And I remember he knew this juggling and magic duo, Romig and Rooney, that lived in Detroit. And he, you know, we were always hanging out in Romig's magic shop. You know, that's where, like, I got all my juggling equipment as a kid. And, but, you know, the circus stuff gave me a real early interest and appreciation for sort of just physical performance, which, you know, so, like, all of my favorite musicians, too, are, you know, people like, you know, Iggy Pop and Mick Jagger and Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley, these guys who were great musicians, but they also had a very physical stage show, you know, and moves, and like all the silent film guys. And then, so he gave me that, and then he also was a rockabilly guitar player and a bluegrass banjo player. And one day he saw me staring at his banjo, and he was like, while he was playing, and he said, "You want to learn to play the banjo?" And I was, yeah. I was probably 12 at the time, something like that. And so he bought me my first banjo when I was in junior high. And
what did you occupy? Like, did you have any, like, you know, looking back and before you made a shift to, like, you're working as a musician, what were some of the, like, the jobs or the way station jobs you might have had in between?
Yeah, I kind of sucked at everything else I tried. I mean, I had, you know, the usual sort of crap jobs, you know, growing up. And I never graduated college, but because I was always distracted. I was always in a band or writing. I mean, the first thing I ever wrote, there was a theater troupe that I was involved with at Michigan State University in Lansing. And we wrote a musical about William Howard Taft. And then after that, I joined that band. So, you know, I always had day jobs and stuff. I met my wife. We both worked at a music store in Lansing called Elderly Instruments. And then after we moved to New York City, I had, you know, a string, like, bookstore jobs and whatnot. But it was always just to get a little bit of money. I never cared about anything but music, you know.
What prompted the move to New York?
Well, I love New York, and I always wanted to live there. And we were living in North Carolina at the time. And my wife, Jamie, got into art school in New York City. And we're like, that's our ticket. We're going. And so we spent, you know, 16 years in the city before we finally moved south.
I'd like to go ahead and take a break and play Sugar in My Coffin, which is the first song I remember seeing you at the Highline Ballroom. And we'll go ahead and play that, and we'll step right back here with Curtis Heller.
I've got to go. I want some
coffin. White House yesterday, and the President Lincoln lost his mind. Well, they caught him in the graveyard, digging in the mud. That's the father of our nation with a sickness in his blood. So won't you listen to me, mister? I want some sugar in my coffin. Well, I said if I really gotta go, I want some sugar in my coffin. I want sugar in my coffin, I want a cup of bitter taste. But the president's a liar, the country's falling in disgrace. If they're ever coming clean, they've got no time to waste. So if I've got to go, I want some sugar in my coffin. I want some sugar in my coffin. Some sugar, mister. I want some sugar, mister. I want some sugar in my coffin.
One of the guys that was in the Squirrel Nut Zippers at the time when you saw us at the Highline Ballroom, the guy who was one of their horn and piano player guys, he's now in my band here.
Did that work out? You moving to North Carolina, was that... You said you had gone... Did you go from Lansing to North Carolina to New York? Or
I grew up in Detroit, and then I was in a band in Lansing, and then we all moved down to North Carolina, and I was sort of the musical director of a theater troupe, and my wife made all the posters and sets and T-shirts and stuff, all the artistic part. But we were only down for a couple of years, and then we went to New York City.
What was your first move? Was it going into open mics or finding jams or just connecting with people you knew prior to moving here?
I became a regular at the Sidewalk Cafe open mic night, the anti-folk thing. And it was great because, you know, there were great songwriters, bad ones too, but as you know, New York really makes you decide who you are and why you are what you are. You know, you have to decide, I'm going to be the guy that does this one thing. I have to be better. It makes you specialize. It makes you, you know, focus, I think. It just, you know, that's what New York's always done, I think, for people, is you come from some random town that doesn't have... You know, what are you going to do in these towns? You know, I mean, it's like, well, there are some jobs, but there's, I don't know, just you come from some boring place and you go to New York and you can, like, reset. You can go, I'm somebody else now. And I don't know, I was just not good at what I do. And so I moved to New York and was like, this is it, you know? If you go for it, you know?
You were playing at the Highline Ballroom. You're standing on a stool. You're swinging kicks. Your leg goes over your banjo while you play it sometime. And then you were doing twirls around the audience. That performance style, is that something you had seen someone else do? Or you organically just started doing that? What was the first time you put that sort of physicality into your live performances?
I like to move and... Being in the, you know, like when I first started as a musician, it was kind of in the, you know, the grunge days, I guess you'd call it, you know, and I was living in Chapel Hill at the time, which was like ground zero for like, it was going to be the next Seattle, so I was like shoegazer bands, I call it, and there was this whole thing at that time in the early 90s of like, you know, don't wear anything that you wouldn't wear on the street, and don't engage with the audience, and don't appear in any way like you're trying to put on a show. Don't, you know what I mean? It was like this whole, we're just guys, you know? And I just hated it. I just, the sort of bullshit sincerity of it. It's like, you're on stage. You four people are on stage. Nobody else is. So, like, right there, it's artificial. And so I always just felt like you have to earn the stage. You know, and the best way to earn the stage is to use it. And, like, all my, you know, like, true rock and roll, like, all the best, you know, the stuff that got it started, Eddie Cochran and Chuck Berry and Little Richard and, like, all these guys, they didn't, like, stand still and look like shit on stage, you know what I mean? They, like, they found a way to look cool and they found a way to move. I mean, if you've ever seen, like, film of, you know, Jerry Lee Lewis lighting his piano on fire and, you know, like, standing on the top of the piano and playing with his feet and stuff. Just, I love that. I love it.
One, two, one, two, three, four. This is the heart that they found. Down by the river, in that frozen ground. Like a cold war fever, it won't cool down. Take a look at my money, take a look at this town. Take a look at that Cadillac, stalled out on the railroad track. Boom, boom, click, click, I'm taking my money back. Hear that music, turn out the light. Can't breathe Kissinger, gonna dance all night. Take a look at those hands in the baptismal pool. That dirty water running underneath the school. Hey mama, simmer down, these people don't mess around. Hey, put the word out, this is my last night in town. They catch you in that waterland, they gonna pull you under and here come that heart attack. I can feel the friction. Wait. This is the heart that forgave Richard Nixon. To know right from the start, I do not have a forgiving heart. Don't you feel the fever when you touch my head? Take a look at that city, everybody's dead. Listen to those people moan, nobody to set that phone. Stepping down the thousand wall, and you will never walk alone. If they catch you in that waterland, they gonna pull you under and here come that heart attack. I can feel the friction, no. Well, don't you know, these are the hands that sign the pardon. Another heart attack, alone in the garden and here they come to overturn that conviction. This is the heart that forgave Richard Nixon. Ow! This is the heart that forgave Richard Nixon. This is the heart lost.
You're one of the artists who I tell everyone, I'm like, you listen to them, here's the, you know, I'll share like a track. I'm like, that's great. But if he's coming in town, you have to come see that. And one of the big reasons for that, you, it seems very important to you that your audience know the story behind your songs. when you play live, or that's part of the song.
Right, with a long story, you know. I'm putting out a live album later next year. We recorded our UK tour, and I made sure to capture a couple of versions of that. But there's something special about somebody telling you a story in the room. Like, I don't know, I feel like there's, every time you do a show, it's like, I'm here, and you're here, and all these other people are here, and it probably will never happen again that this exact group of people is in this room together. And so the same songs can take on a whole new thing. You know what I mean? It's like you have your stories about your life that you tell, and those stories are different when you tell them to different people, right? And it's the same thing with a performance. Like, I think too many people think of a performance like giving a speech. You have a thing that you've prepared, and you stand up and you deliver your speech, and the audience goes, oh, yes, that's very nice, thank you. But the best performers think of a performance as a conversation, you know, and they ask questions of the audience, and they answer questions from the audience, and they you know, I like to get to know people, you know, like, why are we in the room together? And I always say about, like, I think of the songs as, like, scripts. And I think of myself as an actor, and you can do two things with a script and an actor. One, you could make a movie, and I think of the record as being like movies. You know what I mean? You take that script, and as an actor, you do close-ups, and you have sets and costume design and editing and stuff like that. But then the other thing that a script and an actor can do is do a play. And that's what I think of the live show as. It's like, I've got my script, and I'm in the room with the people, and, you know, it's like, so I kind of feel like it's not that different than what an actor does, you know?
And you've said before that you, in both instances, you try to find the funniest way to deliver tragic material. And I guess what I'd ask, why do you like to play in the tragic?
I don't know, really. It's just very interesting, isn't it? I mean, you know, as a performer, like, this sounds really pretentious, but maybe, like, what you're trying to do is, like, shine a light on something, and if it's already lit out, it's already bright, the light doesn't really mean much, you know? If you take something dark, then the light really means something.
You've got a lot of recurring themes that you like to go through. You know, there's obviously this, the circus. The Civil War comes up a lot, silent films, boxers, and of course, you know, Buster Keaton and Elvis are probably the two biggest characters besides Abraham Lincoln.
Richard Nixon.
I remember being very stirred up by your music, and there wasn't anything in the lyrics that's like on the nose about the times we live in, but there's something that immediately you can feel it's analogous.
Yeah, I feel like the big turning moment for me was right about the time the Iraq War was starting. This is about Sugar in My Coffin, actually. This is, you'll probably find it somewhat interesting. There was this book published in the 60s called The Vietnam Songbook, and it was a collection of protest songs from around the world. It was put together by the Sing Out magazine people. And in 2003, they staged this book at Joe's Pub. Don Fleming, I don't know if you know him, he's like a record producer, and he manages you know, historical recording archives and stuff. But he put on the show where they got some of the original people that sang the songs in the 60s, Barbara Dane and just a host of first-generation sort of Vietnam protest singers and Vietnam vets. And then they also wanted to bring in, like, a younger generation of politically-minded people to sing the songs from it. And Pete Seeger, who wrote this amazing song, Waist Deep in the Big Muddy, was, at the time, too sick to attend. He was, you know, like, 90 at the time or something. And I just happened to be the only banjo player that they knew in New York. So I got the gig in the backup band as the banjo player, and then I got to sing Pete's song. And learning that song, which was about this guy who's on maneuvers prior to World War II, and there's this tragedy where they get stuck in a river and drown. But the whole time you're singing it, you're realizing that it's also about Korea, and it's also about Vietnam, and at the time I was singing it, it was about Iraq and Afghanistan, and I sang it for years, and it's like, someday this song is going to be obsolete, and it never happened. The song is always current, and I was like, this is so great, it's so true. And then last minute, Pete Seeger ended up making the show. So I got to sing it for him, which is like an all-time thrill of my life.
Well, back in 1942, I was a member of a good platoon. Where we was on maneuvers in Louisiana, one night by the light of the moon. Well, the captain said to ford the river, and that's how it all begun. And we was waist deep in the big muddy, and the big fool said to push on. Sergeant said, are you sure this is the best way back to the base? Well, Sergeant, go on, I forded this river about a mile above this place. It'll be a little soggy, but just keep slogging, or we'll soon be on dry ground. And we were waist deep in the big muddy, said to push on. Well, the sergeant said, sir, with all this equipment, no man will be able to swim. Oh, sergeant, don't be nervous, Nelly. That's what the captain said to him. Well, all we need is just a little determination. Follow me, I will lead on. To push on. Then all at once, the moon clouded over. We heard a gurgle and cry. Then a few seconds later, the captain's helmet was all that floated by. And then the sergeant said, turn around, man, I'm in charge from now on. Well, we were neck deep in the big muddy, and the big fool said to push on. Well, we stripped and we dived and we found his body stuck in the old quicksand. Well, I guess he didn't know that the water was deeper than the place he'd once before been. You see, another stream I had joined the big muddy about a half a mile from where we'd gone. And we were looking to escape upon the big muddy when the big fool said to push on. Thank you.
on stage, and in addition to being just an electrifying presence in a room, he comes out to the microphone and he says, "I'm going to sing the greatest anti-war, anti-hate song ever written, and I'll need your help singing it." And he did Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And this jaded New York audience, like on the brink of war, was in tears. It was like one of the most beautiful and joyful things. So like what you're singing about is not always really what you're singing about, you know? And so I think and Pete Seeger also made like an art out of the sing-along. If you can get people to sing with you, you're sharing something real, you know? And so that,
I noticed that you're really good at getting people to sing along with you. And I was trying to write up, I mentioned to you a while back. It's like, oh, I'm going to write up this blog post about you and just sort of like a general review. And I had been working on it for a while, and then I had a database failure on my website, and it just ate it. And I never got the energy to muster it all back up. But one of the things I was like putting together a piece was about how you can win over a room. And a great example of that online is you're playing like a small house show in, I know I'll screw up the country, like Sweden or Denmark or something. And, you know, you're asking them at the beginning, like, "Do you understand me?" And their language is just slightly off from us or whatever. And they seemed like they're from a colder culture. They're just more like, "Yes, we are enjoying Curtis Eller. We have good and we have good posture, and we are paying close attention." But you had to melt them down in that, and it's a great example of how you do that. You get getting people to sing along, and especially with a song like "Save Me, Joe Louis," which I may as well just play now so I can stop talking about it. Is that one, by the way, that you think you'll bring out for Carnival? Or do you usually gauge if that's the right room for it, or are you tired of bringing that song out?
I usually try what the audience is looking for, you know? Lately, I've been playing a lot with this sort of explosive rock and roll lineup, which has been a lot of the wilder physical, you know, I mean, you saw us at Floyd's Fest.
And I didn't. I was at that show at Floyd Fest, and your night show was amazing, and everyone was dancing their ass off. And as much as I love Joe Louis, I was like, "Oh, he shouldn't play that."
Yeah, it's like sometimes it's right, and so I haven't done it a lot recently. But it's really, to me, it's a really special song because the short version of the story, as I originally heard it, was in North Carolina. In the 30s, they were switching from the electric chair to the gas chamber, and they wanted to find out if it was painful or inhumane or cruel. So they got a guy, and they put him in, and they waited to see what his last words would be. And back in the 30s, Joe Louis, of course, was a great hero to the African-American community, and a hero to everyone, really. But, if you were a young black kid, he was Superman, you know what I mean? He was the greatest. There's Muhammad Ali, the greatest. But the guy that they, you know, executed was, you know, unsurprisingly, I suppose, a black guy. And his last words supposedly were not, you know, "Jesus" or "mother" or "please don't" or anything like that. Supposedly his last words were, "Save me, Joe Louis, save me." And I don't know where I read this story. Someone in England once came up to me after a show and said, "You should write a song about Joe Louis." I was like, "Yeah, I should write a song about Joe Louis. He's from Detroit." And so I started reading about Joe Louis, and I found that story somewhere. I don't remember where. I was like, "That is awesome." Because, again, we're talking about you're not singing about what you're singing about. Like, that song, everyone says, oh, you have a great song about Joe Louis. But the song is not about Joe Louis at all. It's from the point of view of, and is entirely about, the guy being put to death, you know? Save me, Joe Louis, the last words I'll ever say.
Here's hoping things get better after I'm gone away. If I was there with you, I would drink myself blind. But these hard times could be here all day. And Mr. Roosevelt in the White House can deliver no comfort down here. And I know that it's only a paper moon, but it's the last hope to fight back this fear. I said, save me, Joe Louis, save me. The last words that I'll ever say. Save me, Joe Louis, save me. And let the gas chamber take me. Salt mines, like the tone of a funeral bell, like a blow that could take out Jack Dempsey. I'm gonna call out when they drag me from my cell. Say, save me, Joe Louis, save me, and let the gas chamber take me away. Save me, Joe Louis, save me, the last words that I say. Save me, Joe Louis, save me, and let the gas chamber take me away. Joe Louis, come and save me today.
Same way, but my level of disturbance in politics, and it some of my songs are directly about it, but none of the lyrics are on the nose. It's very open, but I wrote them thinking about very specific things that were happening politically in like the Bush years, and what scared me in those years, the continuity is just the amount of power in the executive branch, and I'm just one of, you know, I'm with civil liberties extremist, where I'm just
Like, that's a good
phrase. I don't know if you follow the work of like Glenn Greenwald. He broke the Edward Snowden stories. He makes a really great point in language that you take the term terrorism and the term civil liberties, and one has very specific meaning. It's like, these are all the things the government can't do to you. These are your civil liberties. And then the other one is just whatever suits it.
And to have a war on it is totally insane. War on terror.
Yeah, then we get on to the, you know, the war on sadness.
I mean, it's just we've lived for so many bad. Anybody that's president is just by virtue of being qualified for that job a compromised and probably awful person, you know? Like, you couldn't achieve that level of power in his culture without being suspect in my eyes, no matter who you are, even the best of them. And presidents are really nice for as a writer, because you say the name of one of them, it comes with baggage about what people think they know about them. It comes with an automatic time period. So you just say Richard Nixon, and you automatically have a cast of characters and the costume design and the sets, 1968. Like, it's all there. You just say one person's name, and you got the whole stage is set. You know what I mean? You don't have to explain anything to anybody, and then you can just let your events unfold on that set. And that's kind of how I look at presidents. You know, you say Abraham Lincoln. It's 1864. The nation is at war. Yeah, it's just you don't need to. It just fills in all the gaps instantaneously for people, and then you can do weird things with it. You know, put the wrong people in there with them and stuff. Treat them poorly.
You've got another theme I pick up is or there's something I love about another song I wanted to play off of the new album, which is Old Time Religion. And
yeah.
I love that that's the title of an old gospel. And
yeah.
You took it and you basically made what I've said to people it's an atheist gospel song.
Yeah, that's what it was intended to be. I listen to a lot of gospel records, you know what I mean? Like, I'm not what you call a believing man, but I grew up in a religious family, and I love gospel music. I love the singing and the drive of it. I feel like it's joyful and welcoming, because you're supposed to sing with them, you know? And I always sort of longed for... It's like when I listen to gospel, I'm like, God, if I could believe whatever it is you're believing that makes you sound like that, I want it. And then I started thinking, well, you know, like, what is gospel? They say it's for sharing the good news, as they say. And, like, for me, the good news is that I don't need God. I'm fine with the world as it is, you know, and I want to, like, I want to write, like, a joyful, driving gospel song for those who do not believe. And for, you know, that's the good news, you know what I mean? It's not a bad thing to say that you don't, like, so many people, like, when you say you're an atheist or you're agnostic or whatever these words are, humanist. When you say that, they think it means you're like nihilistic and you don't believe anything and that it all just leads to death. Yeah, and I try to approach it with humor too. You know, it's like if you can make people laugh when you're talking about it, then they're already smiling. So then, you know what I mean? Like, we're already friends.
I really found that what I would get out of, like, church, or what maybe some people get out of it, and we're that role of, you know, finding community and connecting with them and celebrating something, it is for me, it has been the open mics. And I've had a couple of conversations with friends where I just said, you know, this is church. This is a great idea for church. Instead of everyone congregates once a week and one person stands up and expounds on how they think everything should be based off of whatever source. Whereas everyone gets together once a week and then everyone gets up and does, you know, and we all take turns listening to each other. And that's church. And we're worshiping the creative force that's just flowing through every one of us. And that's how Mike's became a church for me, in terms of, like, I need to go there literally for that communion.
Yeah, it is. It's community. It's community. It's connecting with people around you. It's listening to ideas. It's giving ideas. It's good. But as, you know, whenever I argue with people about it, one of the things I always, I mean, I say this a lot, but when people question, they say, well, do you really think this is all there is? You know, like when you say you don't believe in God, they go, do you really think this is all there is? And I would say, how can this not be enough for you? You know? Like, if you know, like, 10 things, yeah, if you know 10 things about the universe and, like, 5 things about your neighbor, that is enough for, like, an eternity right there, you know what I mean? Like, that's amazing enough for me, and it's joyful, and that's what I was trying to get at with that song, is like, you know, like, I'm like, it's gonna, the world is good enough for me. I don't need the extras. I don't need the full book.
Get ready for the blackout, mama. Everything that you heard is true. Dancing with you, and it's dry wood, but it don't burn, and there ain't no more money to earn. I'm gonna cast my net in that empty sea, and they're passing out the key to salvation, and you don't need a license to shoot that gun. But if I can't be Elvis Presley, I don't wanna be no bull. Hands and that old time religion, that old time religion, that old time religion, drop down and set me free. Don't you know that it's high enough on a mountain, and it's deep enough on the sea, but that old time religion was never good enough for me. Sex don't breed. Lead paint, sugar cane, everything's automatic. I'm gonna build my workshop down in the basement. There ain't nothing up in the attic. Oh, I'm giving up my last chance. I'm breaking up this romance. I'm gonna split the congregation up. I got the clout. Dirty hands and that old time religion, a bad old time religion, a bad old time religion. It's just keeping me down on my knees. Well, there ain't no marble in this garden, no roots beneath this tree. But that old time religion was never good enough. It ain't a good enough. Old time religion, hey, drop down.
What do you have going on right now? You have the carnival on the 30th, yeah, and you're going to have two shows in Astoria and Brooklyn before that. And then where are you off to in the near future?
Things on the horizon right now. Yeah, I got the shows in Brooklyn and Queens. And all of the, actually, one thing I would, is a minor interest, I guess, or maybe major, I don't know, but my show's in New York, and everything that I'm doing in America for the next couple of months will feature my British bass player, because I have a British version of the American Circus. Although I'm not the American band over, but usually I work with these British guys, and one of them, the bass player, is coming over here to see America for the first time. So I said, I'll book some shows. So he's playing here at Carnival and all those New York and Arlington shows, and he's also going out to Los Angeles and San Francisco. So it'll be interesting, you know. So come on out and show
them
a good American time.
I would want to know if there's a track of yours that is a favorite that you love playing and we haven't put out yet that you'd like to close out on.
It changes a lot. I think probably my current sort of favorite might be Busby Berkeley Funeral.
All right. Well, thank you, Curtis. I could bend your ear for a long time on a lot of topics, but this is enough for now. And I look forward to hanging out with you on Saturday, August 30th. And you can find Curtis Eller's tour info and everything else you'd need to keep up with him at curtiseller.com. You're also very prolific on social media. I don't know a lot of artists who are as responsive as you are on Twitter and Facebook. You're really keeping your fan base. You cultivate them well.
Yeah, I want to keep in touch because, as I said, I have to do it all myself. So the best way is to make sure that, you know, people know they can get to me. I can't wait for the carnival. It's going to be great. I had a great time when I did it back in, like, 2010, right? So.
Well, I'm excited for you to hear all the acts. I gotta get rehearsing with Deb here, who's taking a photo of me. Hi, Deb. Okay, so we're gonna take things out with a Busby Berkeley Funeral, and thank you. So thank you very much, Curtis, and I will see you. I will probably see you at your gigs. I'm gonna come out there and maybe hand some flowers.
Oh yeah, great idea.
Audiences.
Cool. So I'll see you soon.
I do not have to worry, because I know what's in store. When the angels crowd around and cast their shadow on my door, there will be no sorrow when they call the final dance. I don't mind, I made arrangements in advance. I left instructions for my funeral with a camera crew. They'll take me down to MGM. They'll know what to do. Tell these Hollywood angels the time has come to gather round. There will be no sweeter sound. I won't Marlene Dietrich singing Lily Marlene when they send me down to the front line. And if it's got to rain, I won't Gene Kelly dancing so I can rise above my fear. Hey, look, the gang's all here. That's Carmen Miranda to wash away my blue. Esther Williams drinking champagne by the swimming pool. Hey, that's Rudy Valley singing in their sweet baritone. Somebody get on the phone and get me hop on Mark's up on a bandstand. I need a Hollywood miracle, a brand new show, a Busby Berkeley Funeral. Don't you know it?
it's girls that dig that hole. I want a Busby Benefit funeral where I go. Right, I want a rainbow shining down on me in sweet black and white. Crank up the camera and let Sam go win. No, oh, yeah. When this old heart grows weak and slow, I'll kill the house light and hit me with that celluloid glow. Here we go, I want a Busby Berkeley funeral. Tell Cecil B. DeMille this is my legendary role. Swing down Hollywood, save my soul. Call out the chorus girls to dig that hole. I want a Busby Berkeley funeral where I go. Don't you know I want down high, save my soul.